Hi, my name is Melissa Weber. I'm curator of the Hogan Jazz Archive, part of Tulane University Special Collections with the Howard Till Memorial Library. And today it's my pleasure to speak with Mia X, the trailblazing rapper and songwriter, actress, author, chef, entrepreneur, and New Orleans native. The first female MC to be signed to No Limit Records, she is known as the mother of Southern gangsta rap, having released 3 studio albums, including the double platinum Mama Drama, and has been featured on numerous tracks by artists such as Snoop Dogg, Master P, and True. A cancer survivor, she embraces the healing properties of cooking, bringing the same passion to the stove as she does to the mic, continuing her grandmother's teaching and traditions in Creole food culture. In 2019, she toured the U.S. performing with No Limit founding artists and taught courses in hip-hop at Loyola University New Orleans. And welcome. I want to start by acknowledging the space that we're in. We are surrounded by the artworks of Brandon B. Mike Odoms and his exhibition Not Supposed to Be Here, with the not in the title crossed out. And his show addresses the idea of who or what kind of art belongs in a museum, offering 4 different takes on inclusion drawn across historical notions of art, race, place, and accessibility. And his works wrestle with themes of heroism, cultural identity, blackness, and our region's present-day ecological reality. And to me, you represent all of these things, so we're gonna get into it. And I'm gonna start off by asking you about New Orleans. You're a native New Orleanian, right?
Yes, born and raised.
Tell us about growing up in New Orleans.
Oh man, I think I had the best childhood in the world, as poor as we were. But I'm from the 7th Ward in New Orleans, and the village raised us. The sense of community was so strong. Everyone knew everyone. We shared food. We just looked out for each other. Being naturally New Orleans, I feel, is when you were raised in one of those neighborhoods from a child. The second lines, the tribes masquerading, so many people sold for the tribes, the food, just the sense of family and community. You don't live in New Orleans. New Orleans lives in you. So even when Katrina happened, New Orleans still lived in me, and I couldn't wait to come back home.
Mm-hmm. Where were you over there?
I was in Dallas, Texas.
Okay, wow.
And missing home. Mm-hmm. Most definitely. You know, this place is very unique. We had a diverse neighborhood, but everybody was still pretty much one. You know, the way we rolled, and this place is, it's unlike no other place, you know. I wish sometimes I could rewind and go back to my childhood.
Yeah, wow. And speaking of that childhood, I recently read in the excellent Gambit Weekly profile that was done on you that you were listening to records at a very young age, and the record that they cited was 1979 Sequence, Funk You Up.
Yes.
So you tell us about loving music as a child.
Well, so my dad was like one of the first African-American rock concert promoters.
Really?
And he was on the road with Chicago a lot. And he would send home so many albums. And my mother had a collection of maybe 7,000 or 8,000 records. And she would play music all the time, so I loved music. And we wrote poetry together. But in 1979, that's when I fell in love with hip-hop, because the Sugar Hill Gang released Rapper's Delight, and then that B-side was Funk You Up. Being that that was women, and shout out to Angie Stone, because a lot of people don't know Angie Stone was a member of the Sequence. Angie Stone was a rapper. But when I heard the ladies, felt like I could do it. So I started writing raps to instrumentals, well, not even really instrumentals, of listening to the instrumental part on records, because this was before, you know, hip hop artists even had like instrumentals to do that too. This is around when Kool Herc was perfecting the merry-go-round. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I fell in love in 79, and the Sequins, they are like one of my biggest inspirations because they were the first women that I heard rap.
Do you remember some of the raps or the music that you rapped to from that time? I know it's way back.
Well, you know, so it was 84 when I actually became a rapper, okay, with my friend DJ WAP and Manny Fresh. We had a group, and I would always rap off of Tila Rock, It's Yours, but the loop that we like to rap off a lot was I Don't Want to Lose Your Love by the Emotions. That was like a big thing. And then it was MC Shadi who actually turned that into a hit record because he sampled it. But from James Brown to Curtis Mayfield, they always had these long but dope instrumentals, you know, that intro leading up to the music. And that became a favorite to sample from hip-hop.
Wow.
Like my first dirty record, The Payback, sampled from James Brown's Big Payback.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about The Payback, but I also want to ask about this group that you just mentioned with DJ WAP and Manny Fresh. Was that New York Incorporated?
New York Incorporated.
Tell anyone who doesn't know who New York Incorporated, what that is and why they are important.
If it wasn't for New York Incorporated, I would not be an MC. So DJ WAP and Manny Fresh and WAP's cousin Denny D, who was actually the founder of New York Incorporated, he was from Queens, New York. But they were a DJ crew. And beautiful thing about growing up in New Orleans, we used to have a lot of teen clubs and teen events. We had a lot of things that we could do. We wasn't just sitting on idle time. And the Pentagon was a place on London Avenue, which is now called AB Turo. And we used to give dances there. Well, one night, Manny and WAP was calling female MCs or MCs just to get up and show your stuff. And I was one of them that did that. and that opened up, we had knew each other because we all from the 7th Ward, but that opened up a professional relationship for me. I learned my craft working with them. We got an opportunity to open up for so many big acts, Run DMC, LL Cool J, when Andre Harrell was rapping and he was in Jekyll and Hyde, The Fresh Prince and Jazzy Jeff. We opened up for everybody. We were like the go-to crew when it came to opening up to the big rap attacks that Mr. Ghost used to give out here in New Orleans. But I owe my experience with New York Incorporated, I owe like who I am as far as my fearlessness. Because at that time, people didn't even think hip hop was real. You know, they still thought it was a fad. So my courage and my guts to actually grab the mic, it started with New York Incorporated.
Wow. And this is the 1980s?
This is 84.
Okay. Wow. Wow. I love hearing that story of New Orleans hip hop scene that early, because a lot of people will start the story of New Orleans rap much later than that.
They'll start it with Bounce.
Yeah.
But in the early 80s, New Orleans had a strong hip hop scene. You know, we had a lot of DJ crews, breakdancing crew, and a lot of dope MCs. You know, we had the Rescue Crew, the Ninja Crew. A lot of y'all know Gregory D from Buck Jump Time. That record was released in the 80s, but we had a strong hip hop community. And then, like hip-hop, you break off into these subcultures. And so I am happy that in 1992, I was part of the bricklaying and what we now have, bounce music.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about that, because was that The Payback?
Yes.
Recording? Okay.
Yes. The Payback was my first bounce record. And I did The Payback because the guys were making so many disrespectful records about the women, and a lot of times we are stuck in a situation where if you can't beat them, join them. So we find ourselves dancing to a lot of music, and we don't really like the lyrics, but we like the beat, so we try to drown out certain things. Or we'll, you know, just take one for the team and laugh and actually sing the lyrics. But I'm looking around and I'm like, well, I wonder how they feel if I would talk about them having a little penis or something. You know, but you know, I wonder how they would feel. And that was the birth of the Payback. Wow. It was a catchback record. You know, I love my male MCs with all my heart, but I had to get them back for the ladies.
I love it. The Payback lyrics, you know, they center women, especially saying, yes, we are supposed to be here as women and not these misogynistic terms that are starting to come out in some of the lyrics of the male hip hop artists. So speaking to that, as a woman, you happen to be a woman, you're in hip hop, what is that like during that time?
Well, during that time, you know, I was by myself. I wasn't with a crew. And most of the time, I was on a stage with the guys that made all of these records. But you know what? About rappers, most of them have really good home training. They have real good manners. A rapper will open the door for you probably before a gospel artist. I'm telling you some real stuff. So I never had any problems. A lot of the times, it's just the music. They're making the music. We imitate our atmosphere. We find what sells. And I think the guys go with it because I never had any problems. Like, I've never been disrespected. And I never felt threatened, you know, like in a situation where I needed bodyguards or whatever. I never felt that way, although I do understand that when listening to records and you're on the outside looking in, one would be like, I don't want to go around any rappers. I mean, are they going to rob me, tie me up? You know, what's going to happen? But most of the rappers, the guy rappers, I look at them just like the actors. I look at them like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I look at them like MacGyver, because outside of that, they are totally different people. Mm. And I was blessed. I didn't have any problems. I traveled with 27 to 100 men on a weekly basis, and I didn't have any problems.
Yeah. And that, the Payback recording, that was before your crew of No Limit.
Yes.
So tell us how No Limit comes to play.
So so much was cut out of No Limit Chronicles. Mm. Well, so see, Murda would come in Peaches a lot. Peaches Records.
Peaches Records, okay.
And I worked in Peaches. But everybody knew I had the Payback out because I would do concerts on the weekend. And one day I was off, and my coworkers called me and they said, there's this guy named Master P. He's from New Orleans, but he lives in California, and he's down here and he wanted to meet you. So I was like, for what? So they was like, I think he's trying to put his label together and he has a project coming out called Down South Hustlers. So I was like, okay. So I was home under the hairdryer. Master P came to my house and he started telling me about the Down South Hustlers project because he had recently released the West Coast Bad Boys project. Now we had that record in Peaches, but we didn't know who Master P was. We had never ever heard of him. Never heard his music. So when he told me about the Down South Hustlers project and how he was going to put all of these different artists from the South on it, I was like, yeah, well, you need a few people from New Orleans. You need Partners in Crime. You need Soulja Slim. You need Trey Ace. I'm telling him who he needs. And he said, well, what you going to be doing for the holidays? Are you tripping on the holidays? Would you come to California? Went to California. And honestly, the way he was working, I saw the drive, and I wanted to be a part of something that was just starting. because I was talking to Profile and I was talking to Big Beat at the time, well, my manager, Tavessa Scott. But P was starting something from the beginning. There was absolutely nothing at No Limit. And I wanted to be a part of it. That drive he had was next level. He wouldn't go to sleep to catch the meetings. And I was like, I think I want to help him do this. So what I say about No Limit, because women never get their say. But I thank Master P for allowing me to change his whole sound, to give him a voice, to give him artists, and to give him what made No Limit one of the biggest hip-hop labels in the world. Because prior to that, we didn't know anything. You know, we had never heard, never heard of him ever. And so he trusted me to say, I don't like the way nothing y'all do. I don't like none of it. And if I'm gonna be with it, it gotta be all this. So he let me bring team players that made our label what it was. Now, you don't hear that story a lot because you don't hear about when women really put it all together. Mm-hmm. But slowly but surely, it's coming out. But I thank him for that, because a lot of times when it's somebody's stuff, they won't let anybody just come in and change it. I changed it. The production team, the artists, had an Everything Must Go sale. And brought No Limit here where it needed to be to make us who we became.
Wow. So you weren't simply the top MC, one of the top MCs on No Limit. You were acting in a role as A&R, production management, and all of those.
Like everything.
Uncredited.
Craft services.
Hair
and makeup. But we were just starting, and that's the beauty of when you start your stuff and when you gamble on yourself, because that's exactly what we did. You know, we gambled on ourselves, and I think we won because we got the opportunity to help the light continue to shine on the South. And so many great labels came after us, you know, and so many labels, you know, strengthened who they were supposed to be in hip hop. So yeah, you know, I'm just so happy for that.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your writing process as an MC, or your MCing process.
A lot of times I just have all these, I don't know if this happens to anybody else, but I have these crazy thoughts that just pop in my head. It might be middle of the night, and I'll just wake up and jot something down. Or if it's a situation that happens and I'm privy to it, it'll inspire me to write. Most of my music, I was inspired by things that actually happened. Some things to me, some things to people I know, some things to people that I know who know people. But my writings have always been inspired by things that happen. Not all the time good things, but still an inspiration by real life. Even my poetry. As a little girl, my mom would encourage me. She got me diaries and journals and notebooks. And, you know, I was the only child for 9.5 years, so I was lonely a lot, so I would write. And it would be life. Going with my grandmother to the card games would inspire a poem. Don't hit people, because you see people fighting at the card game. But just life. You know, when I leave here, this experience will probably make me write something.
Nice. Back to the topic of not supposed to be here and being with No Limit and being from New Orleans. Hip-hop culture starts in New York, and then it was very popular in the West Coast, New Orleans. Recordings were late in the game. Was there any pushback and energy that you recall from the East Coast and West Coast sort of diminishing the new contributions that you all
made? Yeah. What I noticed as we blew up, a lot of artists, they were offended because, you know, hip hop was in New York for the most part, and then it went to Cali, and now the South was just like bulldozing things. But I like to tell people everybody is from the South. I don't care where your grandma and them moved 50, 60 years ago. But yeah, we had some pushback. Sometimes they wanted to bring translators in because they said they couldn't understand, especially me. They couldn't understand nothing I was saying.
Wow.
Sometimes they said they didn't like the music, but as an artist, I can say this, from the East and the West, they've always loved me. I didn't have a problem. I was never called whack. They didn't try to diss me any kind of way. They respected what I did, and you know what? They let me know it. When I met artists from the East Coast, they was trying to say I was from the East Coast. They were saying, well, Mia X is only dope because she's from the East Coast. But they were confusing the whole New York Incorporated thing.
Got it. Okay.
And then I remember being on the West Coast when Sway was a radio DJ at KMEL in Frisco. So I went there with P&M. And he put on a record, an instrumental, like wanted everybody to freestyle, the Far Side. So P&M, they were rapping, and I'm looking around. I said, okay, I'm going to talk about everything on his wall, and he going to understand that I didn't come here to play with him. And so Sway and I became friends after that. He was like, you're dope. You really like the art of it all. I said, yes, the words, not even with the beat, just the words, because a lot of times I write records before I even get the beat. I was like, I like the way words make people feel, even if it makes them angry sometimes. I just like the reaction you get from words. And so no, they didn't ever diss me, but they did. They dissed my crew, and I would be mad because that's still my crew, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they had a little superiority complex, you know, East Coast, West Coast, and almost like our water didn't get as cold as theirs. But all of that changed because I think with music, a song has the ability to marry people even if they thought they hated each other. And for us, everybody was willing to say they was about it. And so from there, the doors began to open and we were accepted.
Okay. You know what I wanted to ask? How did you come up with the name Mia X?
So my name was Polo B.
Wow, nice. Polo B.
Okay. I used to wear a lot of polos.
Nice.
And then in 91, I wrote a record called Ask Them. And I didn't have a rap name. Mm-hmm. So I was going to call myself Just Mia. Like really Just Mia. And my cousin said, no, because we have Just Ice. We already have somebody with that. I said, well, I'm just gonna be Mia. My cousin said, well, that's just dumb. You gotta have something else on it, you know? So I was like, I don't know what to call myself. And then I thought about my personality. So I don't have many friends, but I'm friendly. And on a scene, I'm social in social settings. But in reality, I'm like a hermit. I hardly ever leave the house. And people feel like they know me, but they feel like they don't. So I was like, well, I'm Mia X. I'm the unknown. I will give people what I think they need from me, and then I'm just going to still be Mia after that. So, girl, I can still go to the ballrooms, the card games. I can still eat crawfish on the porch. I can still go to the DJ. I can maneuver anywhere I want because I'm still Mia, mm-hmm. but on the mic, I'm Mia X.
Had the Payback, which is a bounce, has bounce influence. No Limit is not a bounce label or specialized in bounce music. So for people who want to know the difference between New Orleans bounce rap and what No Limit did. What is the difference there in the sound and anything you want to add?
The founding member of Beats by the Pound, he had he produced Lil Elt, Get the Gat. But KL and Parkway Pumping Records, they was never like what you would call bounce producers. They was hip hop producers. And then with Master P living in California, like from what, 87 to right now, he had no bounce roots. Bounce is tribal. Bounce is the soul of New Orleans. It's not just hip hop, it's second line influences, and it's tribe influences, and it's ward chants, and it's native slang. That's what bounce is. What No Limit was doing was a mixture of Southern and West Coast hip hop, because it was P's, what he was doing in California, married to what we were doing here, in a sense of we were still part of the first generation hip hop community before bounce. We was just rhyming. So No Limit was just a hip hop label. Whereas you see when Cash Money came, Cash Money was a hip hop label, but deeply rooted in bounce, because they were still here in the midst of the tribal vibe that New Orleans has. And on top of that, their founding producer, Manny Fresh, had produced more bounce records than people even realized. He was like a first generation bounce producer. So he was able to bring his sound and give them what he wanted them to have to shape what we heard from him. But KLC, Craig B, Carlos, Odell, the guys from here, none of them were bounce producers. But, you know, so that's why we had a whole nother sound.
Okay, that's very helpful. It's really only recently, and we still have a long way to go, that the New Orleans rap movement and scene is being included in stories of New Orleans music in general, when people talk about New Orleans music. And a lot of that, in my opinion, is because of so much of what you all did, which brought the international and national attention, sort of like the recent BET docu-series on No Limit. Why do you think New Orleans rap stories tend to not get included in the stories of what we discuss as New Orleans music?
Because the music had been stolen so long. We had been stolen from for so long. We had heard our influences in music across the coast. But like if someone would come to New Orleans and then go to the club, then they'll leave and we would hear us in their music. But we would never get that credit. And a lot of times people didn't wanna put the light on us, because it would show other people like, oh, well, that's where that sound actually came from. Like I can remember Luke coming down here.
Luke Skywalker.
Skywalker. Okay. I remember Uncle Luke coming and meeting Buzz Down. Well, Buzz Down had already had pop that thing, you got the pop. So after that, Luke, Buzz Down began writing and working with them. So then we got the pop that coochie, pop, pop. We got that. But I remember like, my baby daddy was strong on this music scene. He did a lot for us, but I wrote his records for him when he decided he wanted to rap. But he was the concert guy. He gave $5 concerts and filled the Superdome up. All the concerts at the Municipal Auditorium. But he was good friends with Dougie Fresh. Okay. So I remember he bring Dougie down here. We all go to Club Discovery, this 88. I could remember Dougie Fresh just getting a whole vibe of what we liked and how we chanted on the mic, and he left and he said it inspired I'm Getting Ready. So I just feel like a lot of people, they were coming here, they was listening, and you hear it now with all of the bounce influences, so many records. I remember people thought bounce started in Memphis because DJ Jimmy was, they bit DJ Jimmy and ended up with Gimme What You Got for a Pork Chop. We had already been releasing bounce records for years.
Yeah.
But just like with Second Line, when people come here, they don't realize that our people been in the streets dressed for 132 years, they don't realize how strong the culture is and how long we've been doing stuff. And a lot of times, like I say, you know, we get stolen from so much. The way we do jazz, our whole approach is different. But you'll hear elements in other people's stuff because they have visited New Orleans. Yes, child, everything started in New Orleans, if you ask me.
Yes, I agree with you.
No, I'm playing, but I'm serious.
One thing that's important to me is that we have to tell our own stories, and you have done that with your book, your new book, Things My Grandma Told Me, Things My Grandma Showed Me. And it is part memoir, part cookbook. Tell us about this book and what inspired you to document your story.
My grandmother was somebody very special. And she used to say sayings, and people would always talk about the things she said as well as talk about her food. And my friends was like, you gotta write a book about my mom. So what I decided to do was, from the first time she taught me how to do something in the kitchen, and things that happened in my life, from domestic violence to teen pregnancy. Whenever I would get with my mom, she would tell me something. And the things she told me, I remembered them, even when I didn't listen to her. I thought writing the book and sharing recipes would be a way to break the ice between young women and their mothers and grandmothers if you can't talk to them about certain things. And I wanted us to start cooking again, because my mom got in our business in the kitchen. Come chop these onions up. You got a boyfriend? I heard you yelling on the phone. Are you in a humbug with somebody? And she would find things out that way. And I just felt that now, you know, working people, we're in a hustle and bustle of trying to pay the mortgage and the car note and put the kids in tutoring and other activities, and we don't have a chance to really sit down and know our children and know each other anymore. Mama knew us, and she knew the children on the block too. And I was just hoping that, even though it's so much profanity in the book, whew, I was just hoping that, you know, we would learn to live from it. You know, that's what I was hoping. And people are very supportive. A lot of people love my mom. They love her memory. They wish they would have met her. But yeah, I wrote the book just to share my life, but also I was hoping that it would help somebody. Especially if you are a young woman and you can't talk to your mother or the elders in your life about sex, about drugs, about food, you know, just life in general. I was hoping that if I tell my business, you know.
Help someone else, yeah.
Yes.
And in addition to being an author, you are now an entrepreneur related to food. So and you do so many things. I guess, you know, some people might say, oh, stick to rapping and only rap, but you're like, I do it all. So what is this new thing that you are doing?
You see, it's because it's an old thing, because it's a thing that's been with me since 75. Food is, that was my grandmother's hustle. She was raised during the Depression, and they sold food out the house. Our house was like a barroom on the weekends all the way up until the 90s. And now I'm doing this rice. I have Mama Mia's Foods. One of the things my mom told me growing up in the Depression was a lot of times in the soup line, they ran out when the black people, it was time for the black people to eat. And we eat everything with rice in New Orleans. The reason is because rice stretches. It's inexpensive. If you have more than three children, a pound of rice will take care of you. And so I decided to do my jambalayas, my dirty rice, but also I have a tasty brown rice, a wild yellow rice, and a jazzed up jasmine. And those have more healing properties in them. I wanted the food to be good for us, but good to us, mm-hmm. You know, and all of that. And I decided, especially during COVID, I was looking at the shelves being empty. And I'm like, oh my goodness, there are people home with children. These children are hungry because they're not going outside. Food is expensive. What can I do to show people that I'm serious about food, but at the same time, put some stuff out there that we can fill our pantries with? So I launched Mama Mia's Food with my first seasoning, for whatever seasoning. You can put it on whatever. And it only has 2 tablespoons of pink Himalayan salt. With the food, I'm trying to be conscious of the things that plague us, like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, cancer. So in the rices, I've mixed turmeric and cumin and cinnamon and nutmeg, a lot of garlic, things that taste good, but things that are good for us. And I'm just hoping that they keep supporting me, because I've gotten some really good support from the people. They like the product. I'm hoping that I can grow and get a warehouse so that I can employ young people in Louisiana who love food, so we can be a part of like building and making this food capital really strong. So I'm working, girl.
And I know. In fact, I remember a passage from your book where you're talking about your food, you're cooking for the crew, and it inspired them to do some of their best production work.
Yes. Not only did it inspire them to work, but see, when I wanted the best beats, you know how women, they do couch casting, they say that well, honey, my couch casting was the pot and the stove. I'm gonna make you something, and then I'm gonna get the best beat. I'm gonna get first dibs at the beat. And like when journalists would come, I would cook for them. Mm. And then we would spend a lot of time talking about the food.
Interesting. Yeah, and you also mentioned you cooked on Yo MTV Raps and BET's Rap City.
Yes.
Wow.
I always used food as an icebreaker between myself and other artists and journalists. You know, it was totally different than how it is now. We have a lot of blogs. But, you know, you had journalists come to you and they were serious, ready to end you, but end you with facts. You know, the blogs, they just say whatever they want. But it was a little different. And I would cook for them to break that ice, because a lot of them thought I was this tough, bad girl. You know, they saw me in jerseys and sweatpants, but I was traveling with guys. I was plus size. They never wanted to really go to the mall to shop, so we were all just at the athletic stores grabbing things. And so when people would meet me, they would think they were gonna meet somebody that wanted to fight them. So I would cook, and then they would get to know me as a person.
You mentioned journalists. I am gonna ask this question related to New Orleans journalists and how they were covering New Orleans rap and bounce music in particular in the 1990s. So one local writer who was writing, who was a mid-1990s writer for a major New Orleans newspaper, he once wrote that, quote, "The so-called bounce style of local rap, the sing-song chanting that is popular on the radio, is uncharacteristic of true hip-hop, which emphasizes wit, creativity, and social consciousness," end quote. What do you have to say about that quote, and also how local coverage of local, our local music and local bounce and New Orleans rap music in the 1990s played
out? He wasn't a part of the culture, because if he was, hip hop has always been call and response. And our first MC was Coke La Rockin'. He didn't give us anything socially conscious. He rocked the party. And bounce music is tribal. It's just like when you hear the tribes and you're hearing the chants over and over again. That's what bounce music was. It's about call and response and having the crowd participate with you. There were certain, some bounce artists like Joe Black. Joe Black was very conscious. So when he dropped Where You're From, you would think when you heard the hook that it was just about bucking and dancing until you get into the lyrics of it all. And I just think that that particular journalist couldn't have been paying attention. That's when you hear two songs and you write your article from there. And you're not really up on the culture, because the culture was call and response from the beginning. We didn't start getting messages until the message.
And now you're teaching this culture to students at Loyola University. Tell us about your class and what you want students to know.
Oh, I call them my babies. I call them my babies. The first thing I want them to know is they're not coming to my class to waste their people money. Like, I'm one of those. Look, your mama paying a lot of money. Better come to my class. But my class is hands-on. A lot of my colleagues was like, how are you going to teach them hip-hop? Nobody taught us nothing. And I'm like, well, I'm going to teach them from my experience, because hip-hop is not a textbook course. I say, so they're going to learn how I learned from the crawfish mud. That's how we got to get it. And I'm enjoying it because I'm sharing my experiences. I'm learning so much from them. Oh my goodness, you know, they are bringing me up to this digital world. Mm-hmm. They are open to hearing what it was like and what it's going to take to be an artist. Hip-hop is one of those genres that make you think anybody can do it. It looks like it's easy. It looks like it's just fun and dressing up and videos and throwing money. I don't teach them about that, because that's what they see. I teach them about how there is no pension set up for us. Mm-hmm. I teach them about marrying your fan base with you, because I've been able to do that, and that's a hard thing. When you're in R&B, jazz, country, your fan base kind of grows with you. You know, you think about, we got Gladys and Patty battling tomorrow.
Right.
Okay, they're going to play records from when they were young, young women all the way to right now. A hip-hop artist, it's really hard if you start in 84 to still put records out in 2020 and have that same audience with you. So one of the things I've been teaching them is stay connected with your base and show them little things about yourself that will keep them interested in you. Like for me, it was food. So the crowd that was listening to me, they also cook with me. And now in 2020, I can sing a verse for them and give them a recipe at the same time. And they don't feel like they've grown up and surpassed Mia X. Because a lot of times in hip hop, we feel like, well, I don't really listen to all of that anymore, because now I'm this or now I'm that, and I have children and I'm married. And you have to marry them with you. And that's one of the things that I've been, you know, teaching them.
Wow, that's really good advice. I honestly had no idea of your struggle of overcoming cancer. And that's a real, you know, not supposed to be here factor. When did that happen?
Wait, before that happened, wait, I gotta shout you out. I wouldn't be at Loyola if it wasn't for you.
Oh, gosh.
I need you to know that they told me that you told them to call me. I gotta shout you out for that.
Well,
that was the hook up, girl. Thank you so much, because you did. But so 7 years ago, I was having funny periods, and I would be on the internet literally doing hashtag IHateMyPeriod.com and telling people about how heavy it was and how weird it was. And one doctor told me that I had fibroids, and I did. And so I just said, okay, well, that must be what the heavy bleeding is about. But then it got horrible. And my friend said, you need to go to somebody else, because this don't make no sense. So I went to the doctor and I got it's called a transvaginal ultrasound. And this doctor did see the fibroids, but also saw something else in my uterus, which in turn we had to do a biopsy. And I was blessed because it was low grade, and could be removed through surgery. But that experience taught me to champion women in a way that I had never championed us before, because ladies was in treatment, getting either chemo or radiation and going straight to work as soon as they left. And whenever I would feel really sick, like I just needed to lay down, I would think about, oh, well, I have a friend stage 4, I have a friend stage 3, and they getting up. And so I put a diaper on and went to work and would just get on the stage and say, ooh, I hope I'm not bleeding, because then I will be on, you know, like TMZ or something. Wow. And they would turn this into something ugly, and I'm trying not to tell people what's wrong, because also, when you still have to work, still gotta pay your bills, it's hard to tell people you're sick, because then they don't wanna book you. And for me, you know, I had to try to not be a liability in the sense of I needed the bookings. So I didn't want anybody to know. And how they ended up finding out, when I was in treatment, I used to help a lady that had brain cancer. And I would help her get dressed. And one day she brought her daughters. I never told her who I was, and she did not care, because she did not know. But when her daughters came, they was like, what are you doing here? And the mom went on to say, oh, we help each other. And then they put on Facebook. Mm. And so I had to tell after that. And then I didn't talk too much about it, because I wanted to be booked, because people would call and they would say, well, is she sick? Well, can she stand up? Well, I mean, is she going to be able to do it? And I needed the money. So I had to do it. And a lot of times, you know, I'm thinking about even with Chadwick and how nobody knew. Mm-hmm. It was because he had to work. And people won't hire you. And you still have all these responsibilities, even though you are fighting for your life. And I learned from, you know, my own experience and the women around me, all women know how to do is just do, no matter what. So I would do my concerts, make dinner, go to the doctor. Whenever I was sick, I would stay in bed and just try to push through. I am cancer free, but I was left with some benign tumors in my legs and stuff that sometimes give me problems, you know, and have me dealing with pain, but it's not cancer, and all women know how to do is just do. And I'm going to keep doing until I can't do no more. And when I can't do no more, y'all, I'm going to have 7 second lines, 7 DJs. Just letting y'all know. All the new people that's not from New Orleans, that's moving in these neighborhoods, that's mad. When I go, if you don't go before me, you're going to be mad, mad, mad. Because it's going to look like Jazz Fest and French Quarter Fest. That's what I want people to understand. But yeah, it was a devastating time in my life, a painful time in my life, a scary time in my life, because cancer doesn't care who you are, what you got, who you know, what kind of car you drive, kind of house you have. If it's coming, it's coming.
Well, I am so glad that you are still here and that you are cancer-free.
Me too. I am so glad. Yes, and still praying and fighting for every warrior that's still fighting, and encouraging women, especially for us to listen to our bodies. Because, you know, we get a little pain here, a little pain there, a little pain here, and we just keep on. Mm-hmm. Go to work. 3 months later, well, I'm gonna go to the doctor, but I gotta get the children this, I gotta run and do that, I gotta make sure of this. And all we know how to do is just do, and sometimes when we find out things, it's too late. So I want us to listen to our bodies. Sometimes the heavy bleeding is a problem. Sometimes the pain is a problem, and check on yourself, because we can't help everybody else if we down. So, you know, now I want us to check on ourselves. Yes. Anything you feel that's not right, go see about it.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I'll ask one last question. What should people know about the history of New Orleans rap that you don't think that they know already, that they should know? And what should people know about your history that we don't know?
I would like people to just dig deeper into the history of New Orleans rap. I would like them to Google New Orleans rap 1980s, just to get an idea of the way we sounded, what we were talking about. I also want them to know that New Orleans hip hop is really it's music in itself, you know. Our influences have a lot to do with the musics that were birthed here. You know, Brass Second Line and tribal, Indian, masquerading music. A lot of our hip hop comes from that, you know, our roots. And the stuff we do, it has a lot to do with our families. You know, we make our raps off chants and sayings that came down in our house. You know, I mean, even on the movies, the movie I'm about it, I throw this bullet, my grandma used to do that because she used to loan money to people. And that's how she would threaten them to bring her all her money back, you know? So I just want people to start digging and searching. You'll be very surprised to see who we are, what we sound like, what we've been sounding like, what we've been saying, what we've been doing. It's nothing new under the sun. We were doing things around the same time everyone else was, because a lot of people was doing poetry to music. And so that's what we was doing. But me personally, I want people to know I love New Orleans, everything about New Orleans. And I don't feel that I'll ever be able to give New Orleans enough. So I'm thankful as far as my history. I'm thankful to say that I had a part in building the genre of hip hop music in New Orleans. And I don't know, it's like overwhelming sometimes when I think back to when we first started. To the accomplishments from hip hop, and just knowing I was a part of it, knowing I was a part of like the very, very beginning, is it's exciting. I'm happy, I'm grateful, but I love this place so much. I just wanna see, I wanna see this violence over, and I want us to get a hold on our children again, because we used to have that, and that's how us, you know, the Shamar Allens, the Kermit Ruffins. I remember when Rebirth started. I want us to get a hold on our kids again so that we can see what it is they want to do, so we can bring up another generation of us, but a better generation. Mm-hmm. They got to let us get our children back. We need more things here. You know, things are just different. We got to bring it back.
Yeah. Well, we thank you so much for all that you have done, and you are credited a lot as the most successful female rapper from New Orleans. I have to remove the qualifier of female. Thank you for being one of the most successful rappers of New Orleans, period.
Thank you.
I don't care what gender. And for all of the other things that you are doing in line with this, and you are here, you're supposed to be here, and you inspire us to be here. So thank you again. Nia X.